So today, as Lauren mentioned, this is our last talk on this month's topic, which is ritual and devotion. And as we do in this last sit, we'll spend hopefully a little bit more time in discussion. And what I'll try and talk us through is practices, ways we can bring what we've been hearing this month into our lives. And I'll review some of the things that some of the things that we've talked about this month in that process. I've divided this practice talk into two sections. So if sometimes it's helpful for me if I'm in the audience to kind of hear how things are sectioned. So I'll lay that out for you. The first part, the first practice, and this is a big, broad practice, is discovering the rituals that serve us. So I'll talk in the first bit about, the process of creating ritual, right? What we can do to bring this more into our practice, what we can do to make sure that we're bringing in things that really serve us, that address our needs. In the second part of the talk, I think which will be briefer, I'm going to talk about our existing rituals. Things that we already do, and how we can bring mindfulness to those to learn from what we're already doing, and perhaps even to adapt what we're doing. So, this first bit, discovering the rituals that serve us. We've talked a lot this month about the things that ritual and devotion can do for us, kind of the tools they bring to our practice. I'll mention some of the things that really come to my mind that can connect with me. The first is connection. Ritual, as we've talked about this month, can bring us into connection with our supports, right? If the ritual is something that is practiced by thousands of others, if we're sitting cross-legged on a cushion, if we're chanting a mantra, if we're ringing a bell, we come into connection, whether we know it consciously or not, with everyone who's doing the same thing. And if it's something ancient, perhaps something that's been a part of this or some other religious tradition or cultural tradition, we're bringing in all of those who came before us. We could be bringing in our own ancestors and their practices, right? Things that we've gathered from our childhoods. If we sit at an altar, the objects on the altar can evoke our loved ones. They can evoke a memory, right? Maybe we gathered an object at a point in time that really strikes a memory, or there's a feeling associated with it. Those objects can be a connection to the sacred, right? They can bring us into the sacred. So connection, right? This is something we can get from ritual and from devotional practice. I mention these things, by the way, because in service of this practice, which is discovering the rituals that serve us. So really the first part of discovering the rituals that serve us is figuring out what we need. And when we're figuring out what we need, we want to think about the things that we can get from ritual and devotional practice. I'm mentioning some of those things we can get to see if any of these strike a bell. Oh yeah, I need some connection. If those things are ringing a bell for you, then that's a reason to think about rituals that you could bring into your life that are about connection, right? Another thing that ritual can bring in, focus, concentration. When we sit in a particular place, maybe it's wearing certain clothing, in the presence of certain objects, right? It can bring us into concentration. Sometimes what's actually happening in those moments is that we're reminded. Right? We're reminded of states of calmness or maybe states of expanded consciousness that we've achieved in the past. Maybe that's what's going on. Sometimes rituals are very literally removing us from distractions, right? The place I sit for meditation is a place where I'm less likely to hear the doorbell, right? Or, hear feet pattering around somewhere. So we can use that to bring us into concentration. A ritual could be showing up to this Sunday sit. It could be a kind of push, right, in that sense, to get us away from our daily lives and into a space of practice. Another thing, ethics. The both ritual and devotion can remind us of what our real values are, right? We're connecting to something sacred, and we know it. We know that there's something sacred we're doing. And, you know, when it's a sacred ritual, it's hard to keep up the behaviors that we know are not aligned with our values when we enter that sacredness, right? You know, we recognize when we're doing something that isn't aligned. You know, when we're devoted to something, a practice, an ideal, whatever it is, that thing is a manifestation of our higher values. It's worth thinking about that, right? What things am I devoted to? What things are you devoted to? How are those things a manifestation of your own values? How do they reflect on your values? So we've also discussed this month that ritual and devotion can bring us in touch with the Brahma Viharas, right? Loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. Are these things you need in your practice? Are there rituals that can bring you to that? Is there a devotional act that can bring you to that? And lastly, this is something that we talked about a little bit. I remember Dane bringing this up. It's reducing our constricted sense of ego, right? Acts of devotion in particular are acts of love, acts of surrender. They're in some sense acts of giving that connect us to things greater than ourselves. So, you know, if you find, as I do, that one of the things that's in my way is ego, right? We can think about devotional practices that get us out of that. Okay, so I mentioned a few things that we can get from ritual and devotion. So the actual practice is asking the question, first, what do I need? Right? Do I need more connection to community, to history, to a tradition? Do I need more focus and concentration? Ethics, do I need to be guided back to my ethics? Kindness, compassion, are those things I need to bring in? Ego, is that something I need to work with? So that's the first step. What's in my way? What do I need to work with? Now, if you get stuck in that question, you know, what do I need? That's a tough question. Think about the things you already do. Okay? You know, what do your current rituals say about your needs? What do your devotional acts say, right? We talked about, what does that say about your values? These are questions that can provoke thinking. What do I need? What am I already reflecting in my life? So that's step one. What do I need? And step two is consciously thinking about what rituals and devotional practices can aid you, right? You know, we so often fall into ritual and practice and devotional practice, you know, without really consciously thinking about it. Sometimes it's what we grew up with, you know, and how cool would it be to consciously choose those things, right? This is a pretty personal process, right? What can aid you? So I'm just going to say some things that might stimulate thinking, right? You could adopt existing practices. Right? There are so many things out there that we can research. There are so many traditions already out there. If you go to different Buddhist traditions, for example, you'll find that there are different practices associated with different cultures and traditions. Thailand, Myanmar, India, Nepal, there are all kinds of different traditions. Some may appeal to you, some may attract you. The nice thing about the existing practices is they bring you into connection. So if connection is one of those things you're identifying that you need, you know, things that are already in the world have a lot of power derived from the multitudes of others who are practicing the same things and who have been historically, right? You can also adapt existing practices to your own needs, right? Maybe you like the idea of burning incense, but you prefer Palo Santo wood because it reminds you of that one retreat where you attained some expanded state of consciousness and that smell brings it up for you, right? You don't have to do exactly what comes up in these existing practices, right? You can also design your own rituals, Right? An example here is, what words might you say to yourself as you begin practice? Right? Is there anything you could say as you begin each day, or however often you come into practice? Are there mantras? Is there poetry that speaks to you? Lauren talked about this last week, right? She talked about poetry that could be evocative. And a story here, I took a course a few years ago on self-compassion. And we did this one thing. We spent a whole morning reflecting on how we could personalize, the standard metta prayer, right? May I be saved, maybe may I live with ease. They're all the things we hear all the time. And I think probably for the first 20 minutes, I was just kind of stuck. And then it just started to flow as I started to think about this. And there were all these verses, all these things I could say that came up. And I've adapted some of those into my metta practice. But aside from even the thing you create, what I created during that morning, the very act of designing or adapting these rituals was really illuminating for me, It really brought me into that first question, what do I need, right? So the act of designing can bring us back to what we need. Okay, so recap of this first practice. This is about discovering the rituals that aid us, right? I broke it down into two questions. What do I need, right? What do I need in my life and my practice? And what rituals, what devotional practices can I adopt, modify, or create to serve those needs, right? And those two questions are interdependent. We don't need to get stuck on one before we move to the other. One can help us with the other. A second practice is being mindful of our existing rituals. Many of us formed rituals of practice early on, right? And sometimes it's things we got in our childhood, and sometimes it's when we began meditation practice. For example, I sit in the same spot when I meditate. I ring the same bell. And when I do that, there is a particular feeling in me that it evokes, right? And it can be good, right? It's helpful in many ways, maybe in most ways. It brings about a certain sense of stillness in me when I hear that bell. It also reminds me of states of consciousness that I've experienced in the past, right? And, I think I have this analogy. When I think of places I've been in the past in terms of consciousness, every time we go to those places, I almost think of it as we're tamping down a trail that leads us back to those places. The more we walk them, the more we can see the trail in the future and walk down that path and get to that place in the future, right? And hearing these things, right, when I ring that bell, when I have these rituals that remind me of those states, it kind of illuminates the path. It's like, oh, okay. This is a way that I can walk to that place. This is a way that I can get there. But it can also be a veil on the truth of what's happening in this moment, right? If I'm not doing this with right intention, I can force a sense of calm, for example, on myself if my state is anything but calm at the moment, right? And, if I do that without first becoming familiar with the state that I'm actually embodying in this moment, then I'm not working through that state or letting it pass through me. I'm kind of doing a bit of a spiritual bypass around it, right? I'm going to the state of calm without really dealing with what's there first. So we can do things like that, right? With our rituals, with our practices. Tuareg brought up other pitfalls with ritual and devotion the other day. We can get attached to the rituals themselves, right? As though they're important in themselves, and then we become a little fragile in our practice. What if you can't sit in your usual spot? I have great difficulty, for example, meditating on planes, you know, or in airports. And often that's a time, like I'm in a terminal and this is when I have time, right? Okay, because I get to the airport early. I'm one of these people. So I'm usually sitting in that terminal for an hour and I always think to myself, okay, this is a great time to meditate. But I'm in this terminal sitting on this chair. I'm not cross-legged in my space. There are other people watching me. I mean, there are some real things that are going on. I need to listen to any announcements. Did my terminal change? You know, there are all kinds of things that are real that prevent me from concentrating. But some of it is an attachment to my rituals, to the way I'm used to doing these things, right? You know, so what if you miss this Sunday Sangha? How does that feel if you're if you're someone who's here regularly? What if you have a daily meditation practice and you miss your time? You've got to do it some other time. You've got to do it in the evening. You know, I find myself, I do this in the morning, my meditation. If I do it in the evening, I have all these stories I tell myself. Oh, I can't do it now. I'm tired. It's the end of the day. I'm just going to fall asleep. You know, this isn't the right time for me. You know, I once attended a sangha in which I got really attached to my seat in the sangha, right? Like there were a bunch of seats, you know, I used to sit in the front and there were a bunch of, you know, cushions in the front and chairs in the back. And it would rattle me if someone was sitting in my spot. You know, I was used to sitting in a specific position and the teacher, you know, was in a certain position next to me. And there were people who I was really fond of, who I was used to, I would open my eyes occasionally and I would see them in the meditation. Oh, I was attached to that. And, you know, it would rattle me, but it was also a really good thing. Right. If I was forced to sit in the back in the chair or somewhere else. And sometimes, you know, it would actually bring me into a sort of novel state of meditation. That was actually really good once I got over my rattledness. Right. But what is this all pointing to? You know, we can get stuck on the ritual itself. We can think that that's important, you know. So here's the practice with that. The next time you go through a meditation ritual, it can be your daily sit. It can be taking your seat for the Sunday Sangha and firing up Zoom, right? When you do that, notice what's happening inside you. Something is probably happening, right? Some state change is occurring. Be curious about that. Be kind. Just notice. You can learn from that. You know, you don't have to do this actively during that process. I would say just notice, right? But in this act of just noticing, so we're almost being mindful about the beginning of our mindfulness practice, right? That's what we're doing. When you do that, you might eventually, and I would say don't force this inquiry, become in touch with what serves you. And maybe even things that are in the way. You know? Another thing, another part of this practice, right? So this first part, my invitation is when you go through your rituals, notice what's happening. The other is, what happens when your patterns are broken? What happens when you can't do your ritual? Notice. Notice what happens then. If you're cultivating new rituals, as I proposed in the first part of this talk, what's happening? How do you feel when you're doing these new things? Maybe you've just decided there's something new you want to do to support your practice. What's going on in you, right? How can you make rituals a support, but not a dependency? How can you hold them lightly without clinging? Okay, I want to leave more time today for discussion since it's our last of the month. So just a quick recap. First practice, the first broad practice is discovering rituals that serve us, right? This is a process of adopting existing ones, adapting existing ones, creating new ones. And that process is kind of twofold. There's a discovering our needs, and then there's a discovering what rituals can serve those needs, right? What practices, what devotional practices can serve those needs. And then there's the second practice, being mindful of our existing rituals, right? Being mindful of what happens when they're broken. Learning to use them without becoming dependent on them, without clinging in some artificial way to them. Okay. With that, I'll turn it back to, oh wait, it's me, it's on me, isn't it? I'm doing the breakout groups. Let me give that spiel then. This is the part of our Sunday mornings when we break out for discussion. And during this last Sunday, we often have a little bit more time than we do on other Sundays. So for anyone who doesn't want to do this, this is a time when you can say goodbye. And you can either leave or you can also come back. We will be returning to this Sangha fully for discussion at 11:15 Pacific time. So it's 10:54 now. So if you came back in 20 minutes, you could be part of that discussion, even if you don't want to participate in the talk. But I would also encourage you to participate if it can be a very helpful thing. What we're going to do is break out into small groups of three or four and share reflections on these topics. What practices do you have right now of ritual or devotion? How do they serve you? What are your needs? What are unfulfilled needs? Right? This can be a subject of discussion, or anything else that came up during this talk is fair game too. Okay. I'm going to thanks everyone who replied and said goodbye. Now is that time, and I'm going to count whoever is left and break us into groups. So this is a time when any questions, comments, anything that came up during your discussions, we have space for that. And you can either chime in, we're, I guess, a reasonably small group, or if you raise your hand in the Zoom app, yeah, Leah and Anya, I see your hand up. Please, you can unmute yourself and feel free to speak.
Yeah, thank you. Can you hear me? Yeah.
I can.
Yeah, we had a really great discussion with Linda. Thank you, Linda. Yeah, some really nice topics to think about. One thing that came up for me, and I just wanted to ask your feedback on this, when you mentioned, we can kind of pick and choose from different cultures. So one thing that I'm being really sensitive towards is, I think I shared with you before, I was raised in an ashram. So my mother already, as a white woman, kind of like went into the Eastern tradition, and like we all changed our names to Sanskrit names and things. And so I feel sensitive to cultural appropriation and kind of the idea of like do no harm and, right speech, right action. And, how do we exist with both, in that idea that you spoke of around like, kind of pick and choose and also being really mindful of colonialism and spiritual tourism. And so I don't know if this is the right venue to have that
conversation. It is.
I'm curious what your thoughts would be around that.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. That was something in my mind as I was preparing this too. I think first of all, having that question or that concern is a lot of the work. Another thing I'd say is that if you think to the times when you've seen uncomfortable or jarring or wrong cultural appropriation, we can probably all evoke images of what that looks like in our minds or times we've seen it, right? And this is a personal reflection, but to me, the thing that distinguishes those from times when what we're doing is learning from one, right, which has a very different feeling, right? And it feels like something we want to do and ought to do. The thing that distinguishes those to me most is respect. Right? And with respect comes very often an interest in genuinely learning about the thing that we're learning about from another culture, right? I think to me, that's the most important distinction. And having the concern to begin with is that precondition being met? That is your respect showing up, right? If you're coming to it from that perspective, if you're coming to it thinking, I'm a person from a different culture, I'm a white person, whatever it is, and I don't want to be disrespectful, I want to come in learning and being and appropriately learning from this, I mean, I think your work is mostly done, honestly. That's my feeling, right? Others may come with different feelings, and I'd welcome those of you too. This is my feeling, particularly when I see things that come from an Indian background being used in other places, right? And I see both good and bad, right? Like sometimes I feel like yoga has lost its roots, but you know, I don't know if, and that bothers me a little. I don't think it's a bad thing. In all, but there is in that a wish in me that I wish they would respect the origin of it, and that being the most important thing. I'll stop there. Oh, Sean and Bruce, I see your hand up.
Hi, Arv. And everybody, something happened on my computer. Okay. I have to admit that this has been probably the most challenging topic, monthly topic for me, because I have been involved in other spiritual practices that did a lot of ritual, and those practices were not necessarily good for me. So what attracted me to Buddhism was no ritual, or at least that's the way I looked at it. Not, you know, not chanting, not bowing down to the guru, not giving myself away, to, you know, giving all my money away or whatever. And so this has kind of made me look like, okay, so do I have rituals? Do I want to have rituals? And I mean, there are rituals, like just sitting down to meditate is a ritual, or coming to Sims is a ritual. I see my rituals as being very simple in that way. But one thing you said that struck me is ritual for connection. And that really resonated with me. And I think that's a place where I can open more and dive in, because it appeals to me. Connection with myself, connection with community, and connection with the bigger picture is the only way I can describe it. And that, I think, is what ritual can do to help me keep out of tunnel vision. And that this is just a momentary experience, whatever it is that I think might be going on and on and on. So I appreciate that from your talk. And it's been an eye-opening month, I'll put it that way.
I feel exactly the same, Sean. I have the same, you know, when we were going to talk about ritual and devotion, you know, the teachers get together before each month and talk about, you know, what we're going to say, what the themes might be. And my first instinct was this kind of repulsion. And it was the same thing. You know, I got into this in a way because it felt free of a lot of the things that troubled me in other religious paths and what I grew up with and all of that. For me, it has been similarly challenging to work with this idea, you know, and to think about what I didn't like or what bothered me. You mentioned some very serious harms just a moment ago, where you're really giving yourself to a person or giving your money to some organization. in a way, like I at least was reminded of things that could be very harmful in those processes. The things I had to work with were probably more gentle than that, but they still felt like strong resistances for me. And I think what I've had to work with, and what I'm still working with really, is examining that difficulty, right? Like what in my background, what about what I have done previously as ritual is troubling me? What is valuable to me? And in the question, what is valuable to me, there's what is clearly easy and open to me, right? What are the things that call out to me? And you mentioned connection. Connection is one for me too. Ritual for connection is probably the thing that jumps out to me. But then there is this exploration of what things did I not like? And are those, like, is there a part of that exploration that comes to an understanding? Or do I, you know, am I ascribing some attributes to ritual that maybe I don't need to be, right? Or that I can free myself of? So that, at least for me, that is a part of my process, it's sort of overcoming these resistances that I've had in a sense, and also learning what the real harm was, right? What were the things that really weren't serving me in those rituals? And we've talked a bit about the pitfalls in ritual, and you're bringing up some other things, right? There are pitfalls in ritual when you're being told to do a thing, it's coming from outside of you, and that thing is imposing harm on you, right? That's a very real kind of harm we didn't discuss. Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. Right. Oh, I see two hands. Oh, I see Ali's hand up. I think this may be the last one we can take just so we finish on time. But please go ahead, Ali.
Great. Thanks. I guess I came from an opposite background where from the time I was a little girl, I was craving ritual and tradition. I was not raised with, my mother was a recovering Catholic and my father never really seemed to have an interest in religion. So I'm sure we had ritual, but they were, what's the word? Non-religious. I'm not coming up with the word. And so I've been really examining my practice, and I wonder if there's a, if I'm off course or if it's a bit of semantics here where I'm trying to view a lot of just my daily activities, as sacred acts. And that those can be a type of ritual too, like coming home and taking my shoes off, so that we keep our home safe and clean as we do on retreat, or making tea for my son, and in a way that I know he'll love the milk and honey, you know, just even washing my hands and being mindful of the kindness that is, or connecting with all the other people in the world who are washing hands in that moment. So does that align with how Sims is talking about ritual, or is this, 'cause they're not specifically religious practices or mindfulness practices, in a way that you time out of life. It's just approaching life, from a sense of it being sacred and, an act of kindness and, connection.
I think that's wonderful. I mean, you're making the things in your life that some of us take for granted into sacred acts. That's the way I'm hearing what you're saying anyway. That's beautiful. That's great. And I think a lot of people here have expressed over this month a very similar thing to what you've said, which is, you know, they've come from backgrounds where they've been craving. They've wanted this in their lives. They wanted to create tradition, ritual out of their lives. And yeah, I don't think there's anything that would constrain us to a particular definition of, you know, what is a religious or sacred act and, you know, what is not. You know, I think it's more aligned with this practice to say that this whole act of living is a sacred act, right? And it's something we simply forget. Yeah.
It's easier too than adding more practices. Right. You know?
turning the existing ones into ritual and sacred practice. Yeah, that's beautiful. I think there's a lot in that for all of us.
Thank you.